Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And did you know that April is Eggs Benedict Month? I think it even has a specific day, but who knew? It is probably the most popular brunch dish, and it has even traveled across the shores of America into other lands as well. But I have a really interesting story to tell you about the origins, or not, I'm not going to tell you, my guest is going to tell you about the origins of Eggs Benedict. And even more interesting is we're going to discover the background and history of America's first restaurant. And I say that restaurant with quotation marks around it because the first fine dining establishment, the first to use the word restaurant, and that is the venerable Delmonico's. Delmonico's in New York City in the Financial District, which we now call the Financial District. It was New York way back when. And it all started around 1827. And prior to 1827, people didn't eat in fine dining establishments. They ate in taverns, they ate in boarding houses, they ate in cafes, whatever food was served them, table d'hôte, as the French called it. You got your menu of the day. And it wasn't until the late 1800s, I mean the early 1800s, 1827 or so, we'll get the full story on that, when a couple of brothers opened Delmonico's. They had been coming to America to sell and import wine and other things, and they said, "Ooh, we could do a nice European dining place here. Nobody has that. We might make some inroads in the market." Well, all things happened, and then all things fell apart, and there were fires, and there were changes of location. There were many Delmonico's. But in 1837, they finally built and started they even nicknamed it the Citadel, the massive, fancy, wonderful, I want to say old-style dining establishment. And to really give some of the history and some of the inside stories of that, I have Delmonico's current executive chef, Billy Oliva. And Billy is here with me, took time away from that restaurant, to tell us all about what's happening today at the restaurant, but also to tell us a lot of the history of it. Billy is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America, and he's worked in all kinds of kitchens and restaurants under a lot of great chefs, and including the Tao chef Sam Hazen. And he then went, he, like Eggs Benedict, left our shores and went to cook in places in Europe, in Italy, and most prominently in Ireland, where he took over the Baltimore Customs House. I like what the restaurant bio says about Billy. It says, "Fusing modern influences and traditional techniques with an emphasis on fresh, local, and organic ingredients, Chef Billy breathes new life into Delmonico's signature dishes while preserving the restaurant's iconic history and original standards." And I think that really sets the tone for what I want to talk about today, and that is that although Delmonico's is the new form of restaurant, it's not the original owners by any means, and it's not in the actual original location, in the second original location, but the fact that it is, once again, by my feeling, a European-style grand dining experience. Welcome, Billy.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I have to say that having visited Delmonico's, it really transported me.
Oh, it does. It is classic New York when you walk through the doors.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's so nice to have a place where you can go and dine and have a conversation. I mean, there are a lot of great, you know, little restaurants where, you know, where you can get small plates and have noisy conversations.
Yeah, it's tough to hear. Yeah.
But this is really an elegant place.
Oh, it is. It is. It was. It's history.
It is.
And when you walk through the door, you feel that way.
And how did you come? Now, I know a little bit about your early history. It's in your bio, but you also told it to me. You've always liked these historic places.
Yeah, I don't know how they found me. I started my career in Francis Tavern when I was about 12 years old.
Shh, don't tell anyone. You're
I know,
underage.
I know.
Francis Tavern, for those of our listeners who don't know, is the first tavern in America, I believe.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
And it's, all, again, down in the lower depths of New York City, and it's still there. And it has a museum upstairs as well.
The museum is upstairs, yeah. And I believe George Washington made his farewell address there.
Yes, he did, yeah. So. Okay, and go on. So there, you were cooking there. No, you were working there when you were 12. You weren't cooking.
No, I wasn't cooking. I wasn't. Actually, my brother was the general manager. He's quite a bit older than me. And my dad passed away at a very early age. And my mom was like, okay, now what are we going to do? Now what are we going to do with him? So I went to work there. And I says, wow, I was in the kitchen washing dishes, doing laundry, washing pots. And I saw one of the chefs flambé a dish. And I was like, wow, that's what I want to do.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that it got you. It got in your blood at an early age.
And that was it. It pretty much went from there. We never did anything else.
So you went on to culinary school and then traveled all the world and cooked in a lot of different places. Ended up back downtown.
A block away from where
I started. A block
away,
downtown New York, right, in another historic place. Well, what, you know, my question to you is, it must have been tempting to want to, I mean, obviously you learn to cook so many different things in so many different countries, and it must have been very tempting for you to innovate and put all kinds of new things on the menu, but you've really, as they say, breathed new life into these classic dishes. Tell me a little bit about that experience for you.
Well, it was kind of the whole experience when I first got there. You walk in, you look around, you see what the restaurant is. You have to keep that history. But you also have to realize people don't eat the same way that they ate 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would all be on cholesterol medicine if we did. You know, so my concept was, okay, take those dishes and bring them somewhere into today's world, but still kind of hold somewhat of the tradition.
Right. Lighten them up maybe a little bit.
Yeah, but, take some cream out, replace them with you know, creams with stocks. And.
But hey, the reason somebody goes to Delmonico's is to indulge, right?
True, true.
And, well, then that's interesting because that brings me to an interesting point that a lot of people think of Delmonico's as just a steakhouse. And,
true.
And that, you know, I mean, that not until later in its own early career, late in the late 30s or 40s, Alessandro Filippini. I mean, he's really the one who introduced the steak, right?
With the Delmonico steak, yeah. Which
and now is a cut that you can buy at the butcher. Tell me about the Delmonico steak.
So back in the day with Alessandro, the Delmonico steak was the best cut that he could find at the time. It was the best cut available. Today, that's kind of turned into the ribeye, which is the Delmonico steak. So downtown, well, in all the Delmonicos, we serve a boneless ribeye as our Delmonico steak. It has a good fat content. It's highly marbled, and fat equals flavor. So
that's right.
That's where we go with that.
And it's called the Delmonico steak. And you can go into your butcher and ask for a Delmonico
Correct.
Steak. Correct. Right? Yeah. That really put it on the map. But it's so much more than a steakhouse. I mean, I really have to emphasize to everyone, what an elegant. You know, it's not stuffy, and it's not, you know, you don't have to, you know, wear your opera cloak.
No, nope,
and it's not that old style elegance. It's comfortable, very comfortable, and has that elegance. Fantastic murals on the walls too for people who have not gone in to see, even just to go in as a, you know, as a little side tour,
yeah.
You know, as a museum. It is. Do you have a lot of people coming through?
Every day we have people that come in to take pictures. We must have had three or four people yesterday
coming in, just tourists coming in just to take pictures.
The woodwork, the trim on the walls, everything is just, you don't see stuff like that anymore.
Well, now rumor has it, or lore has it, we're not sure which, that the pillar, if you, we're going to post a picture of the front of the restaurant on the website so people can see, there are two pillars holding up the portico, and supposedly these are from Pompeii.
From Pompeii, yep. Back in the 1800s, they were brought over specifically for that building.
Wow. Yeah. Do we know for sure that that was Pompeii? Well, we're just going to say they're from Pompeii.
Yeah, I wasn't around back. I do know that they say that a lot of the famous Wall Street people that came in and out would rub them for good luck.
Ah, uh-huh. Yeah, because it turned into, it is the money capital. The exchange is right there,
around
the corner. Right? So they needed it. Well, in fact, that played a big part in some of Delmonico's history, because it had its ups and downs. And speaking of its history, we'll get into a lot of the firsts that it had, but just so people know, there were several, at one point, they did like many restaurateurs, they had such a great run, they started to open lots of them throughout the city, right?
They did. They were uptown, they were downtown, they had pastry shops, restaurants. At one point, the Delmonico's downtown was the restaurant, it was a hotel, and it's even been said that it was also a brothel.
I believe that. Has that look. Could have that up, the upstairs.
The
I
upstairs,
could see that
yes,
it would have
upstairs,
that look.
Yeah. Nobody knew what went on
yeah,
up there.
Right,
so.
Right. And those were the days, right? Yeah, that was something. And then little by little, they closed, and there was a big one at Madison and 26.
And that was, I believe, where the fire was.
Is that it? And then 44th Street was the big one that lasted, I think, a little longer. And then, of course, things happened, the stock market crash, or the crash of 29, and, fires and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So little by little, they closed. And the one that you're at now, it stayed around for quite a while and then closed and was rebought by other people, right?
Correct.
And then how long has it been Delmonico's with this company, with this restaurant company?
With the gentleman that owned it now, it's been around 17 years.
Okay. So about 99
yeah.
or so, right. And they really have done a wonderful job trying to preserve that original look.
Yeah, they have trying to preserve it, trying to, as far as the food goes, trying to bring it into the 21st century, still keep all that classic look. We ran into a little bit of trouble with Hurricane Sandy in the basement.
Oh, right.
The party rooms.
Yes.
And we had to kind of do a renovation two times on that room.
Wow, yeah. And was the restaurant closed for any period of time after Hurricane Sandy?
We were closed for about 3 weeks just because there was no power.
No electricity.
Yeah, right? There was no electric, so we had...
There were no food deliveries. There were no street lights. There was no nothing happening, right?
Yeah, and all the damage that took place was on the lower levels, the party rooms, the wine room was damaged, the downstairs kitchens.
Well, you would never know it today to walk in.
No, they did. They did an excellent job bringing it back.
You know, you said bringing it to the 21st century, and that is interesting because restaurants today often are chef-driven. And Delmonico's was not a chef-driven restaurant initially. I mean, it was just a fine dining establishment. And as I mentioned earlier, they had a lot of firsts, which we will talk about. And it wasn't until probably Charles Ranhofer.
Correct. Right? Yeah, Charles Ranhofer.
When he came in,
first celebrity chef.
Right. And when did he come in? The late 60s. I have to look at my notes. Let's all look at our notes. We'll get that. I think that was in 1962. I mean, 1862.
Yeah, the early 1860s.
Right. He came in, and then he really became sort of the first chef to be identified with the restaurant.
Correct. Right? He wrote that Epicurean cookbook.
The Epicurean. Okay, it's a beautiful, beautiful old book.
Yeah, which we actually have a beautiful copy. We just got our hands on one last week from 1894.
Wow, first edition. Huh?
Yeah.
The only thing I've seen them, they're often on auction, but they'll be, like the 11th edition or,
correct,
later
right.
editions.
We have a 1902 edition, which was the only one we had. And actually, one of my purveyors said, hey, I met this guy, said he had a cookbook in his basement for years. It was his great great grandmother's, and he took it out, and it was actually signed by the Delmonico brothers.
Wow,
it's quite interesting.
That is really a find. Yeah, indeed. So with Charles Ranhofer there, and with the restaurant itself, prior to him, there were, as I mentioned, a lot of firsts. firsts in New York City, first in restaurants. Well, first of all, to use the word restaurant, yeah, as I said at the top of the show, right?
Yep.
That word was a French word. It had never been used for a dining establishment. Tell me about some of the other firsts that Delmonico's established.
Well, we'll start with food, and we'll go on with that. Baked Alaska was invented in Delmonico's.
Mm.
Eggs Benedict, which we've kind of briefly ran by.
That was the top of the show, right. So the story about the Eggs Benedict. Tell me what a lot of people claim to have started Eggs Benedict, but a lot of people claim to have started Caesar salad and everything else. And Delmonico's has a story. What is that?
So the story is that the Delmonico brothers love to name their dishes after their friends, the patrons. And that's kind of what they did throughout their run. So Mr. and Mrs. LeGrand Benedict used to come into dinner all the time. And one day she was in and she says, you know, I really don't see anything here that I want on this menu. And the Delmonico said, okay, we're going to take care of you. We're going to make something that you're going to love. And they came out with
Eggs Benedict. Interesting. There have been so many iterations of that dish, but the classic is still on the menu. Do you serve lunch or brunch?
We do not serve brunch. We serve lunch.
Is it on the menu?
It's actually on the menu, lunch and dinner.
Wow.
It never goes off. Yeah,
oh,
it's
that's
always
great.
We have the grill room where it's on all the time.
Hmm. And that was not the only dish that got its start at Delmonico's.
We have lobster Newburgh. Chicken a la Keen. Both of those started. Lobster Newburgh was Ben Wenberg, who was a friend of the Delmonico brothers, was a sea captain, and he came up with this great dish, and he actually made it tableside for the Delmonico brothers in Delmonico's, and they put it on the menu.
They liked it so much. They loved it.
Put it on the menu.
Lobster Wenberg.
Lobster Wenberg. And then they had a disagreement. And they stopped speaking. So the Delmonico brothers were smart enough to say, hey, we don't want to take this off the menu, but we're just going to change the name, and it became Newburgh.
Oh, interesting. Funny how those things happen. You mentioned chicken a la Keen.
Another one.
And it wasn't chicken a la King?
Well, I was growing up, I always thought chicken a la King. I think there might be two, maybe they're two separate. I'm not really sure on that one. But a la King was named after a horse breeder.
Hmm.
Again, a friend of the Delmonico's and a customer, and they named it after a horse breeder.
Well, it was a royal dish, so I think they probably just said king because it sounded better, right? That's interesting. Well, it's interesting because the restaurant was also the first restaurant to use, well, the first restaurant, but it was the first dining establishment to use tablecloths.
Tablecloths.
Such as
printed,
you know,
menus.
Printed menus, yep. Yeah.
First restaurant to allow women to congregate.
That's right. You had to go to a special confectionery if you were a woman to eat. You couldn't come into a restaurant alone, especially. Right.
And it was also the first restaurant to hire a woman.
Really? Wow. In what capacity?
I believe it was a cashier at the time.
Interesting. You mentioned the printed menu, and the printed menu was important as well because as I also mentioned, the restaurants, you had to serve whatever was on the menu or was given that day, whatever they got from the markets or the farms. So this was the first restaurant that allowed you to order what you wanted, right?
Correct. First, you could choose what you wanted.
A la carte. Huh?
Yep, that's
interesting. Well, we're going to talk about a few more of these well-known dishes and the history of Delmonico's when we come back after a short break.
Thank you. 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods, guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Billy Oliva, the executive chef at the famous Delmonico's restaurant in downtown New York City, the first restaurant in America. And, you know, an interesting fact, Andy Smith, a great culinary historian, recently wrote a book on the food of New York City. And he did a really nice piece on Delmonico's, giving the history of Delmonico's. And a story that he unearthed, which I thought was really puts things into perspective. We can say, oh, gee, in 1937, they started the restaurant. In 1962, a chef came on board. But to really put things into perspective as to where America was at that time, he unearthed the story that during the start of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, it happens to do with two things. Abraham Lincoln was asked to declare Thanksgiving a national holiday in 1864. So, you know, this is just during the beginning of the Civil War. And Abraham Lincoln declares Thanksgiving a national holiday. And he also requests that, I don't know how many thousands, you know, thousands and thousands, 20,000 or more turkeys be sent to the young men who are fighting in the Civil War. And who steps up to cook all these? Well, who has a kitchen big enough to cook? But the staff at Delmonico's, they volunteered their staff, and they roasted, I don't know, I have to go back to the book and see. I think it was something, you know, in the upwards of 20,000 turkeys that were roasted, and all this volunteer staff, you know, then got them ready to be shipped down south. And, I mean, that was quite quite a compliment to the Delmonico's and their staff. And is that something you could do today?
We could get it done. I don't think the kitchen is that big anymore, but we could get it done if we had to.
There are some historic photographs of the kitchen, and it looked, in those days, it looked cavernous.
It looked a little scary.
Yeah, and the staff, my God, there were hundreds of people on staff, it seemed. I don't know. It was a...
There was a lot of staff. There was a lot of big mustaches and long beards.
Right. But they all were wearing chef's toques, I must say. Yeah. I mean, the head chefs. That was great. You know, we were talking about the many firsts and a lot of the famous dishes. And did we cover them all? We got chicken. Yeah, we did. And not only the famous dishes with a big name is in the background, but Delmonico's became kind of like the mecca for the rich and famous and the powerful. And we're talking about way back when. I mean, we're talking about Napoleon and Oscar Wilde and Charles Dickens. Right?
Mark Twain.
Queen Victoria. Yeah. I mean, the names go on and on about the people because, well, one could say, where else would they go to dine? But no, but they had heard such wonderful things. And the rooms, there was, I don't know which room that would be comparable to today, well, if it was in the earlier iteration of the restaurant. But I mean, there were banquets with, I mean, huge numbers of people, a couple hundred people.
Yeah.
Where would that have been?
I guess that would have been in that main,
the main room. They just cleared everything out and just, I mean, there was a photograph I saw, old photo.
The first lady's luncheon.
Was that it?
That would have been it. That's one of the photographs we have down at the restaurant.
It's amazing the numbers of people that they would have there and how many they could serve and what they would do. So today, and now that you have, it's sort of like the phoenix that has risen from the ashes once again. This wonderful restaurant has again gained a terrific reputation. Are you seeing famous faces in there as well?
Oh, we do. We do. We
can
see
you, can you tell?
Sure. Well, it's. I think the restaurant has become Mayor de Blasio's favorite. He's been three or four times already.
Hmm.
Whoopi Goldberg, Keanu Reeves, Robin Williams, Adam Sandler.
That's pretty good company.
Bunch of sports guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Football players.
Yeah, that's great. It's nice to have a special place, you know, that people can go. And I think a lot of times, you know, we think of these famous steakhouses in New York, and it's, you were right, you know, like about women, are they welcome to congregate? Because a lot of the steakhouses seem to be like, you know, man's territory. And this is a very pretty restaurant.
Yeah,
a very nice place where, you know, anyone feels comfortable sitting.
You can feel comfortable. The dining room is beautiful. It's elegant. You can come super dressed up. You can come super relaxed. And the food is not just steak. So it's also comfortable for women. Women don't like to eat, at least I think, they don't like to eat tremendous steaks.
Sometimes. Yeah. In that was not the way it was, and if you look at the old photographs, you'll see. I mean, it was an era of special dining, and people wore long gowns, and the men would wear, you know, if not tuxedos, they would be in, you know, ascots,
yeah,
and jackets, and it was, you know, dining was a special experience, and if not bringing back that formality, the restaurant has created that ambiance. And I think that's wonderful by retaining a lot of the murals and, you know, and the upholstery and the tablecloths.
Yeah.
The special party room. There's a special party room too, which is quite nice.
The downstairs, sure.
Yeah. Well, Billy, you are no stranger to accolades and yourself, and you were cooking in. When you were in Ireland cooking at the Baltimore Customs House, your tasting menu earned the Michelin Bib Gourmand Award.
It did. It was a small restaurant. The menus changed daily. We did two tasting menus, a small one and a little bit larger one. And you never knew. I would wait for the boats to come back to know what the fish, whether it was Dover sole, whether it was turbo. So it was interesting. And Ireland is not really known for food, but that has changed
that has changed so much.
As
you know, I talked to you before. I had Doreen Allen on a couple of times, and she alone has helped change the food dramatically.
And the artisanal products available out there. And it actually, I saw a whole different picture. You really learn. You know who your farmer is. You know what they're growing. Some days you might even have to go to the farm and get it yourself.
Hmm.
So it really opened my eyes to a whole different perspective. And that's one of the things I think we took back here. And one of the changes that we made with Delmonico's is let's use what's close and let's use what's around us and, you know, as much as we can.
Well, in the early days of the establishment of Delmonico's as a restaurant, of course, they had the stock trade in their backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a little different. They could just go and grab. Although the butchering was not what it is today. As you said, they would go and get the best cut.
Yeah, whatever was available.
Yeah, which, but they had, but the beef, as I say, the beef was right there. Everything was right there. And there were farms closer by and farm markets. But today it's a little different. What, in your feeling as a chef, what dish do you, that is a classic old dish that's still on the menu, do you take the most pride in recreating?
Wow.
Stumper question.
I gotta
have one.
Well, the chicken a la quine dish, I kind of believe when you come to a restaurant like Delmonico's, I always keep this in the back of my head. Do you want to eat chicken? And so we have to give you something. We have to make that dish.
Over the top, huh?
Over the top. But also kind of stick with some of the trends. And the health concerns. For a long time, the dish was served buttered noodles, pimentos, mushrooms, and peas. That's not very... And it was kind of a sherry cream sauce is what some of the stuff, the history that I've learned on it. So I said, okay, how can we take that, keep the components, but maybe make it totally different.
Okay, so what'd you do?
We use a farro pasta. It's just a little bit healthy. Now we have available to us all kinds of porcinis, black trumpet mushrooms, morels, English peas, tons of peppers, piquillo peppers from Spain. And, you know, so we've kind of just kept it the same with the same ingredients, just changed them a little bit. We do, the sauce is now kind of a porcini reduction. And it changes throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
As the seasons change, you know, the ingredients will change. The one thing we did do, we added a little bit of seared foie gras to it.
Oh, well, come on. That completely changes the dish. That's
that
cheating.
That just puts it over the top a little bit.
Absolutely. But I guess, you know, if you're going to go in, you know, when, as you say, who likes to order just chicken on the menu? But it's funny because that dish became so famous throughout the country, like Eggs Benedict, but more of a, I think, famous in every home kitchen as well. I think every mother at a certain era had her own version of chicken a la king.
Absolutely.
If it was just cream chicken soup dumped on noodles, hey, that's chicken. Throw in a few peas and you got chicken a la king, right?
But, yeah. So.
Yeah. But this, it's interesting that that was a, you know, a very special touch dish that was not a common, ordinary plate of food that, you know, as we would might think of it today. Well, it certainly isn't an ordinary plate of food the way you describe it with foie gras. I'll take the chicken a la king. Thank you. That's terrific. Anything that you've come across that has been, not even say a problem for you, but do you have people, you know, today's dining, everyone's either gluten-free or vegan or vegetarian. What, you know, do you have issues like that? I'm sure.
Every day we deal with gluten-free, and celiac is another big one. It's not really an issue. It's become so commonplace now, and dairy-free. And
what about vegetarian? I mean, you're
vegan.
You're not known to be a vegetarian, you know, vegetable-heavy restaurant.
It's kind of strange when somebody comes into the restaurant and says, I'm a vegan. But we always can accommodate. Matter of fact, we have a party tomorrow where the list of things that this person can have is about 2 pages long.
You say, stay at home. Why come to a restaurant?
No. So,
well, so, they want the experience and to come out, and then to make an effort to accommodate these people, I think, is valiant.
Well, you have to. You have to. You know, and there's restaurants all over the city now, and we don't do it, but just with, you know, and it's one of the things I've often thought about, just vegetable tasting menus and vegetable courses, which is, you know,
they're fabulous.
Yeah,
I mean, just I can't actually envision your creamed spinach dish being on there, which is marvelous, by the way. But yeah, I could see where you could devise something like that, and perhaps that, you know.
I mean, we have there's mushrooms out now that if you grill it and you season it, it's, you'd almost think you're eating a steak.
Sure.
You know, royal trumpets are beautiful, big, thick, meaty mushrooms, and there's a lot of stuff to offer.
And to think that, you know, that would not particularly have been an idea that anyone would have placed on the menu at that time, and it was really meat and potatoes.
Back then it was meat and potatoes.
With a lot of French influence. I mean, there were a lot of French sauces, and everything was served with a sauce, right?
They did.
It was elegant dining, but as you mentioned before, heavy. Heavy, elegant dining.
A lot of cream, a lot of butter.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy to see that the elegance is back, minus some of the heaviness, and that it's a welcoming place as well. And what history it does have. And the location is way downtown in New York City on Beaver Street at William. 56 Beaver at William. And it's a building you can't miss.
It
kind of looks like the Flatiron Building.
Flatiron Building on steroids.
That's right. It's a heftier triangle. That's right. Good description. And it's just, and that whole district is changing dramatically as well.
Oh, unbelievable changes. I will be there about 5 years in August. And just, it's becoming residential.
That's right.
Some of the buildings, the Cocoa Exchange is now luxury condominiums and beautiful buildings.
And that big Spruce Street complex that went up, the big apartment building.
Yeah.
And And it used to be if you went down there after 6 o'clock at night, it was shut down. It was dark and no one was there, right? But now there's activity. There are bars, there's some nightlife, and a lot of shops are opening. You, in fact, have been instrumental in opening a little sidebar to Delmonico's that you nicknamed DK. Tell me about Delmonico's Kitchen.
So Delmonico's Kitchen was their second Delmonico's Outpost. It's on 36th Street between 7th and 8th. And what we wanted to do with that is we wanted to make it a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more. The area is different. It's close to Times Square. It's, you know, close to Madison Square Garden. So a little bit more approachable to everybody. It's kind of a hip, cool, black and white tile on the floor. And it's opened about 2 years. Hmm. And it's doing quite well.
That's great. And you also opened a place in Southampton?
Southampton. This will be our second season out there. Right across the street from the train station, so it's really easy to take the train, right. Come across the street, and we're right
go
there.
Back, right. Yeah. Well, so like the original Delmonico's, you're starting to spread your wings a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. They're doing it really well. The restaurant in Southampton is beautiful, has beautiful outdoor dining. And this year we're going to feature an oyster bar out there, outside.
Now, oysters must have played large on the original menu at the original Delmonico's, right?
Oh, they did, and that is actually a dish that we forgot to talk about, Oysters Diamond Jim Brady.
Oh, right. Yeah, tell me about that.
So, what the dish is, what we do today is there's loads of bacon and cheese and spinach and champagne. It's a champagne cream sauce, and all that stuff is the oysters change all the time. We use different ones. Mm-hmm. The oysters are kind of stuffed and baked, and some shaved black truffle when it's available goes over the top of them.
Once again, you bring it up over the top, right?
And yeah.
Well, Diamond Jim Brady was known to be over the top.
Yeah, that's so.
Yeah, so that's great. And I read somewhere that supposedly the chef back in the 30s was the first to introduce Americans to the avocado. I don't know if there's any validity to that, but the alligator pear, as they called it, and I don't know if that has been verified. But
well, I'm gonna have to research. That,
I mean, there are
one.
All sorts of stories that come out of the woodwork, you know.
It's also I've also heard the first. We didn't invent the hamburger, but it was the first restaurant to put the hamburger on the printed menu.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You figure at a restaurant that's that old, it's bound to have a lot of firsts, definitely. And it's just such a lovely place to look at. And when you look at it, you don't even have to walk through the doors. I mean, you just look standing on the outside looking at the portico and the building, you get a sense of history. And you can kind of, you know, close your eyes and think of what old New York used to look like, you know.
Absolutely.
That was old New York, yeah, and made a real change in how we dine in America today. And I thank you so much for sharing all this information.
Great,
it's been
you.
A real pleasure. And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.